areas where it would be a burden, but we thought that we could overcome that. We did that by introducing a number of new routes. The primary one was the one to Seward that has become a real winner for the railroad. We also put additional routes on the Whittier, made it more convenient, and we carried far more passengers to Whittier back than we formerly did. We did some other things, such as we put in non-stop trains to Fairbanks rather than to stop at every mile post. So we ran a separate train, or a separate little bud car that stopped at each mile post and didn't get in the way of the passenger service. We added the contracts from the tour companies to the already existing train, which meant that we could do that very economically, since we had to run the train anyway. And the tour companies had paid us for towing these cars. All of those things have made the passenger service come up to the level where it is today of being a pretty good operation for the railroad.
Thank you. I have Senator Franklin and Senator Kelly.
Going back to the hotel thing for a minute, whose idea was it for you guys to be partners? Was it their idea or yours?
Theirs.
Theirs. The audit says that the railroad declined to provide partnership financial statements for our review. Why did you guys decline to let our legislative auditor?
It's not up to us to release other people's personal information. They were welcome to go and ask the various partners for that, apparently they chose not to do that, but we could not release somebody else's financial information.
So if you guys make a partnership with somebody, the state of Alaska that owns you and their auditor through the legislative oversight requirement can't go look at your book?
Our books. What it gets down to? No. Our books are open.
I'm talking about the partnership books.
Well, it's not up to me. I would not want somebody releasing my personal financial information somewhere, and I'm not sure how many of us would.
Don't you have to fill out an APOC form like we do? Don't you have to do that on your APOC forms like we do as a board member?
No.
You don't?
We don't do APOC forms.
The railroad board does not?
No.
So how is the auditor supposed to know if your partnership that we own, part of, is financially sound or whatever?
Well, that was a determination that was made internal. Now, I don't remember that audit. The auditors were on the property for 6 weeks looking over the Ship Creek thing, and I don't remember all of the conversations that took place, Senator Frank. But what we told the auditors was that we could not release personal information of another individual, but they were welcome to contact those people themselves and get it.
What obligation would your other partner have to give it to our legislative auditor?
I'm not sure that there is one.
I wouldn't think it would be. It says here in law that except as provided under B of the section, information in the possession of the corporation is public and is open to the public inspection at reasonable times. Then section B, the exception, says that a corporation may by rule designate and withhold public disclosure of matters as of privileged or proprietary nature. Those matters include personnel records, I should say, communications with and work product of legal counsel, and consistent with the standards and practices of the United States Interstate Commerce Commission for the protection of these matters, other information including proprietary information associated with specific shippers, divisions, and contract rate agreements. It seems to me, although I could certainly get a legal opinion on that, that a partnership agreement and partnership financial statement should be open to the public and clearly open to the legislature for financial audit.
We do it at 8 all the time. I mean, we don't have access to 8 of personal financials.
Sure we do.
No, we don't. We can go to Ada and ask for somebody's personal financial.
No, 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 it's not personal, I'm talking about the partnership.
Now, wait a minute now, you, that was the personal, I'm gonna make sure. Maybe I'm confused, that's.
Maybe I am confused.
It was the personal.
Financial statements.
Well, it was the partners, what they wanted was the individual, the partnership financial statements. They got that, it was the personal, you know, their income tax, you know, we looked at their income tax, returns, and we looked at a lot of other stuff, from those people.
Okay, I am mistaken on that point. If they're talking about the financial statements of the partners that are partners in your, partnership.
Yeah, that's what we would not, we wouldn't give them. We wouldn't give them their personal financial statements.
Okay. No, that makes sense, I guess. Just one other question. In response, you don't say directly, so I wanted to be sure that I understood. You made some, reference to, private, well, I guess I'll just read it for you here. In your response, I know a significant portion of time is spent by your staff. I said, I believe the conclusions drawn by auditors are minor and niggling when reviewed in the light of a privately held corporation. Let me be clear, you're not asserting that Lasky Railroad is a private corporation.
No, it was.
You're just saying that they're niggling.
Actually, I took
compared
that
to what they would be if they were.
Right. And actually, I looked at that language from Randy's letter to us. Which was, and he said that in his letter, communication to us, that that yes, those problems were minor and niggling if they were viewed in the context of a private corporation. And I just lifted that language from him on the letter.
I see. Okay. But I guess his point is that you're not private, you're public, and therefore they wouldn't be minor and niggling, they would be significant. Then. Is that the right?
No, I'm not sure. Of course, he's best to interpret his what he was trying to communicate. But I guess the and where we often get crossways with legislative audit is that there is a difference in the way businesses are run and the way state agencies are run. And we tend to run, though we are well aware of our ownership situation, we run our organization as a business. And so things are done in a slightly different manner. And that is, and that is the derivative of much of the...
Okay, I just want to make sure that you didn't, that I didn't misconstrue your comments to say that you think of yourself as private.
No, we're well aware of our ownership.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Kelly.
Well, is Bert and Steve done with that particular thing? Because I want to talk about Lydia.
Senator Grant, can we go to a new topic?
We're here, yeah.
Senator Kelly.
The Lydia Road, is that a net win or a loss for the railroad? How's that affect you guys financially when we get that road put in there?
Well, right now we handle something in the neighborhood of 175,000 passengers in and out of Whittier. Well, obviously, they're duplicates, but in and out of Whittier each year. With the advent of a road into Whittier, that will go away. I can't imagine us running a shuttle operation into Whittier after that. It doesn't seem to make sense. Because the overall operation loses money, it would probably be a net benefit to the railroad. But I would be, I wouldn't be candid if I didn't. The nice thing about passengers is that they pay in advance, which freight customers don't normally do. So the Whittier shuttle does generate an awful lot of cash in the summertime. It's nice to have around because that's when we go through the most of it.
Hey, one more thing, just that the hydro train runs out of there, and that is a profitable operation. It could also possibly operate on a
sewer. What's the hydro?
Hydro train is where the barge comes in, and it's railroad cars that are transferred from the barge to the train and brought into Anchorage. Aqua all the way up to Fairbanks, I guess. And so it's not containers loaded onto a flat car, it's full box cars. We just really have to rethink sewer now in light of this whole thing. And because of the city there, the railroad lane running all the way across the waterfront there, there's no way that they could develop.
That's Whittier you're talking about.
Whittier, that's Whittier, yeah. So, again, that would be very valuable real estate in terms of development of, if the road goes in, there's going to be a lot more traffic from Anchorage there. It's going to become much more of a, what's a gateway to Prince William Sound? So I think we just have been talking about, we need to rethink what all this means to the railroad. And for sure, it's going to be a net benefit to Whittier, really help Whittier.
Okay, so in essence, to change the subject a little bit, given the amount of capitalization you pour back into the railroad every year, your train loses money, both freight and passenger, and essentially subsidized by your real estate.
That's in large part true. Yeah, there are
varies from year to year.
It varies from year to year, but generally the way you want to put it in broad brush, we either win or lose about $2 million each year in the transportation business, and any net that we get from real estate operations, which is what allows us to go into the financial markets for short and long-term financing. If that were not available to us, chances are we'd have an entirely different
Having to subsidize passenger service.
We would be probably sitting in front of you more often than you'd like to see us, but it would be with half in hand rather than the discussions we're having today.
We've got, one of the things that's easy to overlook is that about 70% of our business is in the hands of Usabelli and Matco. And I can assure you that if something were to happen to that refinery at North Pole, it would have a much more serious effect on the bottom line of the Alaska Railroad than it would on the overall bottom line of Matco. That's a tremendous amount of our business. Now, they are currently examining the possibility of doing a pipeline between their refinery and Anchorage. And if they do that, that's a significant amount of our revenue that goes out the door.
Wouldn't they have to use your right of way?
Not necessarily, no. That would be nice, but it's not necessary. The export coal business, everything has to work perfectly for us to even recover our out-of-pocket costs on that. That could very well go away here in the next few years. The announcement of a gas pipeline that goes through Fairbanks doesn't necessarily warm the cockles of my heart, because the other half of our coal business will, in time, not in 3 weeks from now, but in time, that will probably all be converted to gas. So we look at a planning horizon out there of where is the growth for the Alaska Railroad going to come. I can't pick up the tracks, as I said, and move them over to Soldotna. I can't pick up the tracks and move them over to someplace up on the Yukon. They're where they are. We've got to make do with what we've got. And this is why tourism and passenger business is so critically important to us. And that is because as I look out onto the horizon, what areas of growth do we see on the rail belt? Well, that's one of the significant ones. And obviously, as population grows, the boxable freight that goes back and forth between North Pole and Seward and Whittier is an important aspect to us. But our foundation business, the resource business, is certainly not something that we can just sit back and assume is going to be there for the foreseeable future. In fact, based on the information that I have today, I'd be better served to assume that it won't be there, because they are. The coal is in trouble, and the petroleum is the Matco is at least examining the possibility of doing a pipeline.
Who would want to buy the Alaska Railroad if it were up for sale?
Well, it is up for sale, and has been since transfer. We have had no nibbles of which I am aware. And
well, I guess within the last few years it would not, but Sealand, for example, was very interested in buying the railroad. They, of course, owned the shipping and trucking, and the rail would give them another way of transporting their goods. They indicated an interest. They also are owned by CSX Railroad, so it was within the company. Something more on that. There have been other small investors have indicated an interest that we have not taken seriously because I think they want the real estate and not interested in the railroad.
Well, I'm just wondering why anybody would purchase it if it's so tough to make a living off it without the real estate income.
Because real estate is the only reason they would be interested.
Yeah, this is the whole thing. I'm sure all of them would not take a risk on just the railroad itself.
So what would they do if they purchased it with the real estate?
Well, that would, of course, Senator, would be up to the governor and the legislature. You set the terms and conditions of the sale. And I would assume if a credible buyer came forward and went into negotiations with us to purchase the railroad, that the legislature, and we would certainly recommend that some fairly stringent conditions be placed on the sale as pertains to real estate, as pertains to continuation of freight and passenger service. Presently, we have no authority without your authority to sell any real estate. We cannot sell real estate. We are limited in our leasing to 35 years, as you well know, but certainly it would be in the best interest of the state if they determined it was in their best interest to sell the railroad to put some fairly stringent conditions on the continuation of the asset.
And if we did that, why would they want to buy it?
They wouldn't. Other than the potential money they could make on real estate leases against what they perceive to be the ability of the transportation of passenger portion or the freight passenger portion to at least break even. And as Mr. Hatfield has pointed out, that's a very tenuous. I'm having trouble with my dictionary.
Difficult.
That's a very difficult thing to predict because, as pointed out, the gas pipeline is going to have a tremendous impact on the railroad, primarily because of the Fairbanks situation and coal. It's certainly, if MAPCO elected to build a pipeline, would have a tremendous impact on the railroad, and I don't think anybody would look very favorably on buying the railroad and having to maintain its operation for $4 or $5 million a year, virtually guaranteed coming in on real estate against some tremendous potential losses on the other side of the budget. I don't think a prudent businessman would consider that without some very extensive due diligence and discussions with potential users of the railroad that generate the largest volume of our income. And we have no control over that. It's not like competing with truckers over the railroad. We're competing in the international market on the coal situation, and we have no control over what those prices are, nor does Usabelli have any control over those prices. They're set by Japan and Australia once a year, but the coal international Pacific prices are going to be. So there's no negotiation involved. It's here's what we will pay you. If you can meet it, we'll give you 700 tons of business. If you can't meet it, you fulfill your contract for the rest of the year and we'll see you later. So it's Usabelli, Sunnyvale Railroad are in some tough situations, and any potential buyer would look at all of that. If you put the railroad up for sale with no conditions whatsoever, I think you would attract some interest, and primarily because of the real estate. And I think you would see portions of passenger service go away. Passenger service probably only in the summertime when it's profitable. I think you'd see some major differences in freight handling. That's my opinion. But they would make their money on the use of the real estate and the disposal of the real estate.
Can I have one more thought? If the railroad had been operated totally as a private company, we would not have done the things that we did to help save the Korea coal export contract. No question about it. And part of it, and why, you know, you've got the Commissioner of Commerce and DOT on there and some other publicly appointed members, we got a lot of jobs at Usabelli. We've got jobs at Seward. We've got the jobs of all of the people that work for the Alaska Railroad that own homes and spend money in the local stores. So I think you'd really lose the public outlook of the railroad if it were totally privately owned. You'd lose a lot of the services that you have, a lot of employment.
Different topic, the letters from the city of Nenana that I think we provided to you. Representative James is in a House Judiciary Committee hearing. She was not able to come up, but she did ask that we ask the railroad, and I told her that I would for your comments on the allegations in the letter to you, Mr. Lounsbury, that Nenana has been working with the railroad to develop a landfill and has apparently been told by ADEC that the railroad is developing a landfill that would compete directly with the Nenana landfill. I don't know whether you're prepared to.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Let me just preface it and then let Bob discuss the details because I have not been involved in day-to-day discussions. For some time, and we have some of the articles in the paper at our board meetings for the past approximately 2 years, and well, I can say 2 years because I've been back on the board that long. We have at virtually every one of our board meetings discussed the potential or the possibility of a waste disposal site in a remote area along the railroad. That was primarily in conjunction with toxic waste, hazardous waste, everything but atomic waste or nuclear waste that would provide a source of revenue for us, of course, for hauling this waste, but also operating the disposal site. Now, these disposal sites are under the auspices of the EPA and other governmental agencies that must direct how they are constructed, where they're constructed, and license you to operate them. We felt, since there is a tremendous volume of waste emanating in the North Slope and up and down the rail belt that have to be shipped outside the state of Alaska for disposal, which, by the way, is a source of income for us, hauling it to Seward or Whittier, we felt that it would be an opportunity for us financially and also a benefit to the state to investigate the possibility of a waste site. In conjunction with that, and I'll let Bob finish it up, there were discussions with the municipality or the city of Fairbanks. They're having difficulties disposing of their solid waste, and I understand they're rapidly filling up their facility. And there have been discussions of the potential of taking their waste away. And there have been discussions with Nenana. Now, I'm not fully informed on the nature of those discussions, so I'll let Mr. Hatfield take over from this point. But this is not something that happened on the spur of the moment and hasn't been discussed at great lengths for at least the past 2 years, but I suspect even prior to that when Frank is the CEO. There's been no, we've selected a potential site that's a possibility. We have, the management has met with DEC to discuss the ramifications of such a facility, and on and on. I'll let Bob then explain the Nenana situation.
Well, I passed out a copy of that article, and I apologize for the photograph that's there. That was not the reason I passed it out. The reason I did, I just wanted to call to your attention the date on that article, which is in October of 1991. We started to become interested in the solid waste business. I'm sure there was some interest prior to my arrival, but my personal involvement in it started on my first inspection trip over the right-of-way. When it becomes clear that our revenues are as focused as they are, as I mentioned earlier, we need to look for areas to expand. As I went north of the park, I came upon two separate areas where there was debris stacked up. One is at Mopples 301, it's ties and a bunch of other stuff that's dumped there. And it became clear to me that it would probably be in our best interest to go into this sort of business. We have been working with ADEC for an extended period of time. We have been discussing with the city of Nenana their operation, and what we intend to do initially is land farming, where we take contaminated soils that are contaminated with oil and that sort of thing, and spread them out and put bacteria on them, and then the bacteria tend to cleanse the soil. That was what we intended to do up in and around at Mopples 388. What is particularly disturbing to me about this letter is that there is what appears to me to be an allegation of some sort of inappropriate behavior on our part. And frankly, these kinds of allegations are getting sort of tiresome. We did not take any competitive information from them and then suddenly decide to go into the solid waste or hazardous waste business. This is something we've been looking at least since February of 1991, when I came onto the property. We have been negotiating with the city of Nenana. The city of Nenana's proposal takes an awful lot of money to get going. We're not going to stand in the way of their proposal. We would be just as happy to deliver freight to the hazardous waste to Nenana as not. But we still are in the process of developing our own plan in the event that theirs does not go forward. Now, their plan did not call for land farming, as it's called. Dealt purely and solely with solid waste and with solid waste, as I understand it. But in any event, we have been looking at this for some time, and what is most disturbing to me is the allegation that we somehow took their information and then decided to run off on our own and compete with them. That just simply is not the case.
I would appreciate having a copy for the committee of whatever letter the railroad does send back in response to, if you just copy it, as we...
Madam Chairman, I may point out that we are attempting, as we speak this week, for Dick Knapp and other members of the railroad administration to meet with the Nenana people and the people in Fairbanks in a joint meeting to try to resolve or straighten out the misunderstandings here. And as indicated in the letter, he requested a meeting on February 20th. We happen to be having a board meeting on February 23rd, in which the mayor will be invited if he elects to and feels it's necessary in view of the meetings that will take place, I understand, this week if everybody can get together. But there is an attempt to sit down with all parties concerned and try to iron out whatever the misunderstandings are here. It certainly was not the railroad's intention to get in competition with the city of Nenana with solid waste management. As Bob pointed out, if they are able to provide a facility that will handle solid waste, we will be delighted to haul them to their facility. If they are unable to do that through whatever reason, we are prepared to go forward, at least conceptually, with the plan that we just described, which is basically land farming or dirt farming, as we call it, and conceivably in the future could be, if Nenana isn't in the business, solid waste disposal for Fairbanks or even Nenana for that matter. But our intention is not to go into competition. It would be ridiculous.
Senator Kelly, on that point,
yes.
Senator Frank, could you on that point?
Was it Nenana's plan to draw solid waste from Anchorage and Fairbanks? I mean, just all over?
I really don't know, Senator. I suspect more from Fairbanks.
They were going to have a transfer facility as well. They would take waste from the bush and it would come up the river by barge. And they would process that as well as whatever other contracts that they might be able to get. But there are bridges that need to be built. There are a lot of things that are involved in that. That may or may not receive funding. And in the event they don't, then we stand ready to do our thing. But the dirt farming thing is something that we were going to do as a start anyway, and had been talking with ADEC. I'm not exactly sure when the first discussions were held. I was not actually involved in them myself, but they were some time ago.
Senator Frank?
Couldn't you project greater earnings if you owned and operated it yourself?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But you just don't think it's appropriate to get into this or what?
I'm not sure.
How does this differ from the hotel? I mean, you can project greater profits if you do it yourself.
Well, I suppose that's true. We haven't made a decision on that score. Chances are, if we did that, if this were to become a reality, we would take a company with a particular expertise in treatment of this sort of thing and have them operate it at a minimum on a contract basis, if not on a partnership basis.
Senator Frank, we were looking in the very beginning and still up to this point at toxic and hazardous waste, mm-hmm. which is not what Nenana is talking about. In doing that, we would have to have either a contractor who is licensed and highly trained in the handling of toxic and hazardous waste, or we would have to hire people and have them trained to do that. We have not gone anywhere near reaching those kinds of decisions or conclusions. We're still in the study and discussion phase.
Okay.
To go into the hazardous and toxic waste business is a relatively expensive thing initially. To meet all of the requirements of EPA and DEC, or ADEC, and federal and state requirements. That is why we don't have a lot of toxic waste sites throughout the United States. The first phase of all of ours is Oregon, the Central Oregon area, at a very high cost, not just the transportation, but it has to be barreled. And then, of course, the individual who has caused the waste is liable forever for it, even though it's in somebody else's care. So it's a very complex business, but there's a lot of money to be made there. And so that's why we were looking at it. Also, it's a service to the state. Our customers would not have to ship their waste outside. As a adjunct to that, in recent times, last summer, there was some discussion with the municipality of Fairbanks about the problem they were having of a rapidly filling up waste facility, solid waste, not hazardous, but solid waste, normal garbage, that they were seeking another location. Now, I assume, not having been in the discussion, the Nevada people are the ones that have had that discussion with Fairbanks, and as we say, we see, frankly, the bulk of the money, or where you can make a much better return on your money, is in the hazardous waste area rather than in regular garbage.
That would be because of probably greater risk, I see.
Sure.
I note that here in law it says that state oversight reports under your section of law that the board shall provide a state oversight report to the governor and legislature before undertaking expansion, reduction, or diversification of services. Now, would this be a service that you would intend to bring before the legislature before you would engage in under that section of the law? Are you familiar with that section of the law?
I am. I haven't read it recently. But we would certainly comply with any section of the law, Senator, that requires us to do certain things, whatever that may be. If it requires that type of an approval, then obviously we would do that.
But you wouldn't, if you just got involved in a partnership with somebody that did that, then that would fall outside of this requirement? Or?
Well, I think so.
So if you went into partnership with the hazardous waste company, waste management or somebody like that, I don't know if they do hazardous waste, but on railroad land, and you got into an operating agreement with them, you could do all that, you would do all that without coming to the legislature first and providing an oversight report as contained in the law here.
Yeah, I would think that the structure of it, and certainly we provide the legislature on an annual basis, both orally and in writing, what we have accomplished or done in the past year and what we intend to do in the next 5 years through our five-year plan and through the annual reports and, of course, our financial statements, which I might add along with the minutes of our board meetings,
There's a specific provision here to if you're going to expand services. And so I guess, I don't mean to belabor the whole topic, but that must not have been viewed as an expansion of your services because you didn't own the hotel 100% and you don't operate it, so you don't consider that an expansion of service.
Well, I don't, but I don't know that I went through that rationale in making that decision. I don't view it as falling under that section. However, that's why we have legal counsel at our facility to advise us in those matters. And I can assure you, if our counsel feels that we're stepping beyond the bounds, which by the way has been very, very rare, but we're stepping beyond the bounds of what we're entitled to do under the Act, we're brought up short and told so.
Lauren, could you
have no fear of that.
Could you instruct your counsel to review that particular section? You might
sure.
want to blow it up and stick
sure.
it right over his desk.
He may be over there.
Her desk.
Who is your counsel?
Phyllis Johnson.
Any other questions? Okay, we very much appreciate your having the patience to come before us today and answer all of our questions. I predict we will see you again, because I think you brought up some points that created even more interest, if you will, but I do appreciate having a majority of the board here to talk about some of the philosophical questions that we have.
Will you waive the requirement that we give public notice if we have a quorum? We have four board members.
That's what I was noting. We do have a majority of the board.
Who else is on the board, by the way?
Frank Chapados of Fairbanks, Dale Lindsay of Seward, and Mike Olson, who represents labor.
Senator Frank?
I did speak with Frank yesterday. He called me, asked me what all was happening on down here and about the hotel situation, and he agreed with my position that the railroad should lease the land and not get into the operational businesses. So I don't know, you know, how much unanimity there is on the board on this issue, or what, maybe there's a change of heart, or maybe there can be a change of heart, I'm not sure, but I just wanted to note that he agreed with me, at least it was my impression, that he agreed that there was...
I've talked to Frank quite a bit about this. When you said operate, that threw him off. He meant we should not be managing the desk clerk and reading the rules. Operate for him didn't mean an equity, unless he's changed.
So you've talked to him since I talked to him?
Pardon?
You talked to him since I talked to him?
No, I have not. But I say previously, well, that...
yeah, those questions
Frank's
were raised.
Concern was operating.
And then the equity position, is that just with debt? Or equity as a result of them using the land? And that's another whole question.
Leasing land?
Well, leasing, or let's say we put up the land and we get part ownership in a hotel without incurring debt.
You need to be correct. We cannot sell land. We have no authority to sell land without legislative approval. We can lease, but not sell.
You can't give partial ownership as a result of the lease?
At the lease we can, but we cannot. We cannot give fee simple.
And then putting up the land for lease.
Yeah, that's what we did.
But we also incurred debt.
Sure.
On top of that. But if we didn't incur debt, that's another question.
That would be a variation, and I'm not sure whether that'd be appropriate. I haven't thought that through. I've thought through this a lot since I talked with Mr. Hatfield, Mr. Fairbanks, and still arrived at my own personal philosophy since that. But I'd have to think about that, thank you.
Or just lease and then a percentage of debt or gross, as Senator Sharp mentioned. Another possibility.
Yeah, that's more common.
Okay.
Also less profitable.
Once again, I do appreciate your being with us. And with that, we're adjourned. Finance Committee will come to order. It's Monday, February 15th, 1993, 11:20 a.m. Present are Senators Pierce, Frank, Sharp, and Kelly, and Reeder. Welcome, Senator. Today we have capital budget overviews of Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Anchorage and Fairbanks International Airports. We have John Unger, the controller for the International Airports, along with Gina Marie Lindsay, director in Anchorage, and Bob Bullock, manager for Fairbanks. We also have Randy Simmons, from Doc Hook. How would you like to proceed? Does everybody want to come to the table?
If the please chair would like to support the two of the managing directors and the controller to come to the table.
Terrific. Okay. I brought them in here so everybody could enjoy them. They were making me sneeze. If you need to just state your names for the record, please.
I'm Gina Marie Lindsay, Director of Anchorage International Airport, and I thought, if it please the committee, I'll just give an overview,
Okay. Kind
of a layout as to where the two airports are and what's happening with traffic, and then we can go where you like with specific projects. Traffic-wise, we're running counter to the rest of the United States, and we're up about 8% in domestic passengers. And I believe both airports are experiencing that. Bob may want to be more specific when we get to Fairbanks. Cargo has been up a couple of percentage points, but in the recent 4 to 6 months, we have seen a bit of a downturn, and what I expect we'll see in the near future is probably a flat cargo outlook. That's due to some extent because of the world economy. It's just flat enough that we just don't see a whole lot of growth there. And it's also due, at least in Fairbanks, or in Anchorage, there will be a couple of flights that, Federal Express flights, that used to be going through Anchorage that won't any longer. For at least the 6 or 7 months during daylight savings, they're able to make their curfews in Japan, taking one of their flights directly out of San Francisco instead of coming through Anchorage. So we'll see a dip on that as well. International, of course, our passengers are down. I expect this next year, calendar year 93, to be our low point from an international passenger standpoint. We're down about 58% from 1988, which was the high year. That was our fiscal 92 calculation, was the 58% drop. My expectation since that point, having lost British, more like around the 65% drop from the 1988 year. So that's kind of what it looks like traffic-wise. I think that our master plan, which we have underway at Anchorage, ours is just underway, Fairbanks is further down the road than we are, will help us with more current forecasts as to what to look for in the future. In Anchorage, we'll be revising our land use plan and putting together a comprehensive development plan for the airport. We'll also be identifying low-cost alternatives to effectively manage the general aviation side of the Anchorage Airport in the wake of not moving ahead with the major expansion on the general aviation side of the airport. So those are, I think, some of the biggest issues that the master plan process will be wrestling with. Our marketing plan continues to center on cargo development and specifically looking at any alternatives and possibilities there may be bringing in international carriers to then transfer cargo to domestic carriers in Anchorage for flight on to the rest of the United States. So we'll be working that direction cargo-wise. Passenger-wise, we're still working with carriers to reinstitute direct Europe and Asia service out of Alaska. That is slow going, and it's slow going to a great extent because of the economic condition of the carriers, all of the carriers, not just U.S. carriers. We have a light on the horizon for that relative to Asia, but we'll just have to see whether it materializes or not and whether the carrier stays in solvency. Industry-wide, we wouldn't be complete in talking about our airports situation without referring to the airline economic situation. I think it's well known what a crisis the airline industry is in nationally, internationally as well, but most specifically within the United States. We are receiving, as airport operators, a fair amount of pressure from the air carriers to reduce costs at the airport. Now, our approach on this is to be sensitive to the situation they are in, because it truly is a bit of a partnership, and their troubles do affect the airports. There's no way we can close our eyes to that. So we do want to be sensitive to that without being reactionary, however. we've taken the stance with the air carriers that we, the airport operators, still have the responsibility of running a safe and efficient operation. We still have passengers getting on airplanes. We still have airplanes landing and taking off. And it's also fair to note that industry-wide airport costs have remained about 3 to 4% of an airline's operating costs. That's been constant for about the last 10 to 15 years. So in putting together our capital and operating budgets, our requests are intended to be frugal, but they're also intended to be structured so as not to let the airline economic woes of 1992 compromise the future of the airports and the traveling public. So we're taking a longer view than the airlines are at this point in time. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to John, since John has a couple of system capital projects, and to determine the desire of the committee as to how you'd like to proceed through the projects. Would you prefer to go project by project or go by exception?
I would prefer to go project by project. Is that all right with everyone else? Let's do it that way.
I have a question.
Senator Kelly has a question.
Yeah, on the international terminal, mm-hmm. You know, I've heard that it's underutilized, and what are the long-range plans for that? And rather than build expensive additions to the domestic terminal, why can't we just use it?
We've had a task force that's been wrestling with that issue for the last year. And it is underutilized. The alternatives are to look at a major modification to that terminal in order to make it usable by domestic carriers, or to leave it the way it is and see if our expectation comes to fruition. And that expectation is that origin destination international travel will gradually grow for Alaska. Our sense was that a minimum of 4 gates needed to be kept as available for international flights. That would leave a balance of 4 gates that might be able to be modified for domestic passengers. Problem is that the terminal was built very specifically for wide-body aircraft, and it has very little bag makeup and bag claim facilities because there were not very many passengers getting on and off airplanes there. So the modification that has been envisioned would be very pricey. $18 to $20 million is what's being discussed. And we've taken the tack that we don't want to make any final judgment on where we're going with the international terminal before we do an engineering evaluation of sea concourse in the old terminal. We do have quite a bit of money in this capital budget request for terminal projects, and they're all tied together. One of the problems that the domestic carriers have certainly noted is that sea concourse is falling apart, literally. I think we've got a question as to whether we're going to have to put major money into sea concourse to keep it operational, whether we rebuild the sea concourse or whether we demolish it totally and put all our money into the north terminal, into the international terminal, to reconfiguring it for domestic flights. But the critical piece of information that is missing in that is the engineering evaluation of sea concourse, which has just been started and we expect to have the results of in the next 3 to 4 months.
When was sea concourse constructed?
Late 50s.
Which one? Mid to
late 50s. That's where the Era and Pan Air take off. It's the old concourse.
To the right as you're standing in front of the terminal?
Yes. The mechanical systems and plumbing systems are failing in that concourse. And once we get the engineering evaluation, we'll have the information to make a value judgment on whether we pour money into rehabilitating it or simply get rid of it altogether.
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Give me some quick overall figures here. What's the operating cost of the Anchorage International Airport?
We're at about $35 million.
And what are your revenues?
$15 million.
And they all come from the IARF?
That's correct.
So you're going to spend you're proposing to spend $15 million in capital?
Now, the way our revenues work, we have what they refer to as a residual agreement with the carriers. They guarantee us that they'll provide enough revenues through our different rate-setting mechanisms to cover the Anchorage and Fairbanks operating budgets, the Anchorage and Fairbanks capital budgets, and our bond debt service for every year. If we happen to charge too little, they're obligated to pay an additional amount. If that $50 million turns out to be too much, whatever's excess,
would be applied against the bottom of his land. So it's totally a break-even type of setup, the rain that we have.
Jean Marie, for the record, could you go through the process you actually go through with the, under the operating agreement with the carriers in terms of these are the projects we'd like to do and then what they can or can't do about those projects,
sure.
Please?
Every year we put together our capital budget request and send it to the carriers by the beginning of July. We have a meeting with the carriers where we discuss each of these projects by the middle of July. And then within 30 days thereafter, they have the right to vote on each of these projects. If 67% of the signatory carriers vote against a project, we will delay that project for 1 year. The following year, if the airport still feels that it's an important project and we want to propose it again, we then can take it through the second budget process to the carriers, request that they vote on it again. And if 67% of them again vote the project down, we have the right to go ahead regardless, but they have achieved a 1 year delay.
And our signatory carriers change as airlines leave?
Yes.
Okay. How many?
Does Peninsula Airlines, for example, have the same clout as Alaska Airlines?
It's a one-man, one-vote system, so it doesn't matter how much land and weight you bring, how many passengers you handle. And yes, Penn Air has the same clout as any other.
Do you want to explain when we negotiated how they bring that up?
That was a compromise because the local carriers, of course, would feel like they were tremendously outweighed if the value of their opinion was based on how many passengers or how much land and weight they brought in. So it was an acknowledged concession on the part of the larger carriers to accommodate the smaller carriers and keep peace in the family, essentially.
How many carriers do we presently have in the system?
We've got about 25 signatories now, I think. Now, I should point out that when a carrier leaves, this is a five-year operating agreement, so we essentially have a five-year contract with these carriers, and if one of them leaves the system, for example, Swiss Air, they are on the hook to continue to pay for the space that they had in the terminal, even though they're not using it, unless we find someone else to use it. And technically, during that time that they are still... they still have a contractual arrangement with us. They still have a vote.
I see. Okay, Senator Frank and then Senator Rieger.
Now, with your International Airport Fund, do you maintain a balance from year to year in that fund?
Yes.
How much is in there now?
There's approximately $70 million of cash in the fund. About $40 million of that is set aside for capital projects that have been appropriated over the years that are in various stages of completion. In addition to that, our bond covenants plus our operating agreements lay out minimum reserves that the airport's required to maintain. It's a year of bond requirements of interest and principal. It's 25% of an annual operating budget in case of a catastrophe. There's $12.5 million for capital improvements and $10 million for a development fund. Anything above those reserves ends up going back to the creditors and reduced rates in the following year.
And that's annual.
That's annual.
Senator Frank. Sure.
And then what's the overall indebtedness in bonded debt?
Right now we're sitting with about $43 million of outstanding debt.
And how did you intend to finance the 40 some million in capital appropriations this year? All right, it's nearly 50.
The bulk of our capital this year will be looking for federal programs, either our federal entitlements through cargo and passenger entitlements or discretionary funds. We typically get 93.75% of any capital project that's going for federal grant money, and then the International Revenue Fund makes up the difference of 6.25. There's also some projects that will be totally funded through the revenue fund. When a project is put in place, it's then amortized over the life of the asset and is built into our rate base that we then recover from the airlines.
In addition, when the money is appropriated from the legislature, that money is earmarked or encumbered, and it's money that the airlines put into our fund over the years that we then have to restrict and make sure that it's available to complete the capital appropriation.
So let me make sure I understand this. You are getting federal funds outside of what we normally think of as FAA or Federal Aviation Administration funds? Randy Schaefer is head back there.
This is the Federal Aviation Administration.
Anchorage and Fairbanks together have both passenger entitlements and cargo entitlements, resulting in it's a little over $7 million for Anchorage. About a little less than a million for Fairbanks. And every year, we have access to at least that amount of money. This capital budget request identifies projects in excess of that amount because there is, on a national level, there's a discretionary pot of FAA money that we could compete for on a project-by-project basis that would be over and above the roughly $8 million that we have access to every year.
Over and above by about a factor of five or six times?
Depending on the timing of when we draw it down.
Okay. If I could just understand this, I'm not that familiar with how it works. Are these funds that come in for the Anchorage and Fairbanks, are those just for international airports?
Yes.
So that money is distinct from the money that we, the other federal monies that we get for all the smaller airports out there?
Theoretically, the passenger entitlements, which run up to about $4 million of that $8 million, and I'm speaking roughly here, would be able to be applied to the other airports. However, in our agreement with the air carriers at the international airports, we said, because you guys are supporting the other costs of the airports through your rates and fees, we agree that all the federal money we earn at these two airports, we will also spend at these two airports.
And just one thing, is this seemed like a large amount to me. I haven't paid that close attention to it in the past, but is this in line with your average over the last several years, or is this dramatically increased?
This is a little bit higher for Anchorage, and the reason is that our terminal projects, you'll see in here about $8 million, I think, of terminal projects, and you'll actually see closer to 12, but $3 million of it is for sea concourse repair and rehabilitation, which is what I was mentioning earlier with Senator Kellen. But new terminal projects have been on the horizon for quite a while, and last year when we went through our budget process with the airlines, we said, this is what we're looking at. We've cut our revenue fund portion of our capital budget by about 50%, but you will see next year identification of terminal design and terminal modification monies. So that's the big blip that you see this year that we didn't have last year and that you don't see carrying forward in future years.
Chair,
go ahead.
The single largest appropriation or allocation seems to be Old International Airport Road Reconstruction for $11 million.
Right.
Now, you don't anticipate doing this unless you get additional federal money?
We anticipate phasing this project over several years, but we're asking for the authorization all this year, even though we wouldn't draw down the money. And that project is a project that was very important to the airlines at the time it was requested. But it's a very developed area, if you're familiar at all, with the frontage road along Anchorage International. There's a lot of utility work that's going to have to be done and a lot of relocation, so it's an expensive project. There's no getting around it.
So but you don't intend to draw down your reserves or your fund balance to accomplish this work?
No.
Outside of the federal fund. You intend to maintain that balance of 90-some percent coming from federal funds?
Yes. That project we expect to be 93.75% funded by the federal money.
Yeah, but so that's going to take either some good luck that other jurisdictions didn't take advantage of their money, and so therefore you get some additional discretionary money, or you're going to have to do it over several years.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Kelly?
Yeah, how do you determine, how do you make a decision that you're going to bond it? What makes that decision?
Sure. We discuss it with the carriers, and when we negotiated the operating agreement, the carriers come from the standpoint of wanting to see as much bond indebtedness as possible, because it puts off the obligation. And none of them know how many of them are going to be here tomorrow to pay the bill. We typically take the more conservative approach and say, no, we want to fund it out of cash, we don't want to compromise our future, and we have, by virtue largely of the duty free revenues in the past, been able to maintain that and still keep fair and equitable rates for the carriers.
I would require, you know, to go through a bonding issue, we would look at a fairly large project before we think from in-house, we would want to bond it. Typical bonding projects we've had in the past was the Parking Garage in 86 for about $36 million, the International Terminal for about $23 million back in 85. I would assume, depending what comes out of our studies on Sea Concourse and the International Terminal, we're forced to either convert the North Terminal into domestic use or actually tear down Sea Concourse and build another one. That would be a project that we would look at for bonding or possibly passenger facility charges.
What is your debt service every year and what pot of money does it come out of?
It comes out of the International Revenue Fund. It's been running about $7 million. It's gone down recently because we totally paid off last year our Series C. We're in the process of refinancing our Series F this year, and we're beginning to look at possibly Series G. If all these refinancings went through, I think our annual debt service would be down as low as $4.3 million. Again, the principal and interest payments are all built into our rates that the airlines cover when you pay our rates.
Isn't that kind of a high debt service?
Compared to other airports, it's relatively well. Most airports are leveraged up to the hilt, and that's what's causing the problems. As carriers pull out, the remaining carriers are being forced to pay for projects that carriers that have left have already gotten the benefits.
One last question. It seems to me that, and I guess you're going to correct me, but it seems to me that airports have this kind of Widow Winchester attitude that if I don't keep building, I'm going to die. Nobody foresees a boom in the Alaska economy in the next several years. Why do you have to expand the terminal?
Oh, I don't think you see any terminal expansion project in here with the exception of one. $4 million for the North Terminal, which is to provide bag makeup and claim area for destination flights. The North Terminal was built simply for transiting flights. There are none of the areas that support bag claim and bag makeup, and that's what we're proposing to build. Because I think the traffic we're going to see coming through there, even though it won't be a big boom, and I agree on that, the traffic will be destination traffic, so it will have bags to check in, they'll have bags to claim, and there are no facilities for that over there now. They're certainly not adequate for the charters that are using the terminal today.
Are they paying their fair share? I mean, is Morris Air off? Are they one of the signatories here that pay the debt and everything?
They're not a signatory. They pay on a per-use basis. They pay the same landing fee that all the carriers do, and every time they use the international terminal, they pay a $500 docking fee, which is the same as everyone else pays if they use the terminal.
Is there anything that limits the amount of debt you can incur?
Our capacity to pay it, I guess.
They call it vice statute. I think we're authorized for $110 million,
$115 million
debt.
Authorized?
Authorized
by who?
By the legislature.
And there's a specific number in statute?
And that was incorporated in our 68 bond measure.
1968?
For the record, Senator Petula is joined. Senator Rieger, questions?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have been answered now, but I'm just trying to get a picture of the almost an income statement for the year you're projecting. So if I understand, we have $50 million in revenues and $35 million in operating expenses, and then another $7 million, hopefully declining to $4.3 million of debt service, and the remainder, if it's $50 million capital project and it's about 7% IARF, that's where I get a little lost. Can you count for the whole $50 million?
I think there's about $20 million in here that's IARF.
Actually, there's $58 million. $50 million was for Anchorage, and then there's another $6-7 million for Fairbanks.
Yes.
The terminal system would be looking at about $58 million.
Okay.
That $35 million of operating costs is for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the system office.
Okay. Okay, so 58 and 35 and the 7. So there's another 16 million, and that last 16 million is what's going into capital?
About $1.5 million that we pay out to the interagency charges for the different DOT groups that provide service to us every year. The remainder that would basically be going to capital.
And that does work out to an exact break even, you know, the way all these capital projects are going forward?
I really think it would be pretty close. What happens we end up putting together these projections for revenue, and in 6 months we fine tune most of our actual rates so that we can make sure that it does come to that break even. Yeah.
Okay. I guess what I'm driving at, the capital budget you've proposed does not draw down on existing cash balances or build up more cash balances. Pretty much leaves the status quo of your financial situation.
Pretty much. What we get every year in our rates is appreciation on the old projects and the amortization. That's running about $13 million net for the system. So that's what's being built into the revenues. If our capital projects, as well as all the operating bond. So if our capital projects per year are less than what we're bringing in appreciation, there would actually be money left over that would then go back to the carriers, offsetting next year's rates for the carriers. If that $13 million is something less than what we're proposing for the following year's capital, we basically would be eating out a little out of the fund, and there wouldn't be any rebate back to the carriers for all the rates.
I got you. But on a cash flow basis? It's a wash. Okay.
Senator Sharp, did you have a question?
I
could have waved, and I wasn't sure.
I believe in answer to Senator Frank's question, if I heard right, you said that there was approximately $40 million of construction in progress from previous years.
That's correct.
So, if this would take it up to 80 to 99, in progress, if this 45 plus million is approved?
Including federal, less whatever's completed this year.
I don't know, unless I missed it. Did you give a breakdown of the source of the $45 million between federal, international reserve funds and bonds? Since there's no general funds, this is all under in our budget. I know in the individual sheets it has it, but without adding it up, what is the breakdown between the federal and the international airport reserve and any bonds, if there is any bond revenue anticipated on the 45 million?
The way it's shown in your 5-year capital improvement program book, it shows $22.5 million additional authorization request for Anchorage, and 11.8 is revenue funds, 10.6 million is AIP funds. The concern I have about that is that I know just the International Airport Frontage Road project is $11 million, which is darn close to that total federal.
But there's no anticipated sale of bonds to finance any of this $45 million?
No.
So it's strictly federal and international airport. Okay.
Senator Kelly?
Well, so you have no bond proposals on the table right now that are being discussed? If you don't get all this money, will you then discuss your bond proposals?
I don't believe any one of these projects is big enough to really think about bond proposals. So we'll be on half of the market this year refinancing our bonds, not to increase our bonds for any
year. When you're refinancing your bonds, how far in the future are you talking about? 10-year bonds?
Series G goes out until 2015, and that would be the furthest out. We'll be refinancing. Series F goes out until 1998, and we're just going to refinance it for that same period. Take advantage of lower interest rates.
Okay, one last point. Federal Express, how's that working out? And the status of the Alaska hangar through ADA, whatever happened, and could it ever come back?
Federal Express, I think, is working out well. I mentioned earlier that they're dropping one of their flights, which we're disappointed to see, but they have had a steady growth in traffic through the airport, which has benefited us and the other carriers through sharing a larger part of the landing fees and the cost of running the airport. So it's working well as far as we're concerned, and I think as far as the other carriers are concerned.
Are they making money?
Is Federal Express making money? They had a good quarter to report last quarter, but that's not broken down by just the Alaska operation. I can't tell you whether they're making money just on an Alaska basis or not. I don't know.
Okay, because I've heard that they weren't, and it's not a good sign, but what about the Alaska hangar?
It's pulled off the table. They say it's canceled, not deferred. Whether it could ever come back or not, what I'm told from inside the company is not within the next 5 years. And that seems to be pretty realistic from what I can see outside the company as well.
Same for Tula.
Did we bond for the construction of the overseas offices, you know?
The international terminal?
Yeah, terminal, right.
It was mostly cash. Was there any bond money in there?
It was about $23 million here.
Some state from the city. Now that is a loser right now, Jack.
Yes, it doesn't pull its, it doesn't make its operating costs.
How big a loser is it?
I don't know, because the way we calculate it is...
Do we have that information roughly?
I don't. Do you?
Right now, the state accounting system really doesn't allow us to start doing much cost accounting. Because of that, we, for the last 2 years, have been putting a maintenance management system in so we can start actually setting up and seeing what the cost of certain buildings, certain sections of buildings, certain runways. And in fact, one of the capital projects that we'll be proposing is to let us take that even further by getting our own in-house computer.
That's pretty easy to see. It's a big one.
I wouldn't say it's a big loser as much as it used to be a cash cow, and it's definitely not a cash cow anymore. When duty free was bringing in over 30 in revenues, it was definitely a large contributor.
But that was a fairly brief period, this case may be. It's been, what, 2 or 3 years out of sync now, since Mount Spur, as you say.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was a good 8 years that duty free brought in a lot of money since the time that terminal was opened in 1982. And the airport's still making around $2 million a year off of duty free.
It made about 3.7 last year, and figure about $2 million
this year. $2 million next year.
Okay, one thing then, since there is a bond debt, so it's not happening for this. Is there any optimism that we're going to somehow increase that? That's what we really have optimism.
Real guarded and not very optimistic. I think we'll have a lot more domestic international flights 5 to 8 years from now, but I think we're going to have a couple of years that are about as flat as what we see right now, which is Aeroflot and Air China and China Airlines, and that's about it.
Okay, then can we use that for some domestic flights? Is there any reason to use that for some domestic flights?
It's a very expensive modification because the jetways are built for wide-body aircraft, and they're about 3 feet too high for most of the aircraft used by the domestic carriers. But it's possible.
Yeah, but you have to use the stuff for electric.
Yes.
That might be something for an architect to ever have to build another and have multiple use potential.
There's a lot to be said for flexibility in designing a facility. All right.
Thank you.
How do our landing fees presently compare with our gentlemen, please? How do our landing fees presently compare to our primary competition, which I assume is still Portland,
Seattle,
LA,
yeah.
Seattle?
Yeah. They're real comparable. LA's is less than ours. But what we typically would look at is a cost per inflamed passenger for the airlines operating out of our airport. And it's tough to find good comparisons, but from what we can gather, it looks like we're right in the mid-range.
Senator Kelly, do you have yet another question?
Well, Madam Chair, one more. Exit fees, they make me mad when I have to pay them at another airport. Have we looked at charging them?
Yeah, we've looked at it. A passenger facility charge, which was authorized 2 years ago in federal legislation, and the carriers are saying that they're really interested in having us move ahead on that. Because I know it would be irritating to everybody having to pull out $3 in Anchorage or Fairbanks, we have not wanted to look at imposing those until we had a specific project to tie them to. And I was hoping a project that would be real visible to the public as opposed to a runway overlay or some of the airfield improvements that are more visible to the carriers than to the public. So that's been our stance with the carriers, that we will wait until we have some kind of a project that's real visible and benefits the public clearly before we want to move ahead on that.
How much would it mean to you? How much revenue?
We're figuring probably we could raise about $3 million a year.
And then on a 20-year bond, how much could we bond if we had $3 million a year to pay it back?
The bond house is typically only using 50% of that. It's a range of revenues because it's such a fluid number that could change any kind of carrier left or came. So on a 20-year basis, you might be looking at a $30 million bond using PSCs.
What about how much could we bring our landing fees down with that same $3 million?
It would have no effect. PSCs can only be used for capital projects.
Oh, they can, under by federal law.
By federal law. What you'd need to do is to apply to the FAA with your application and shopping list of capital projects that it would be used for. And that's the only use that you can use the tax the facility charges for.
Can they be used as a match for the federal funding?
Now, actually, the federal funding gets cut on the large and medium hooks. You lose 50% of your federal funds if you, to the extent that you receive PSCs.
Okay.
It's not a totally additional source. You're really only getting 50% of that money.
Senator Frank.
Yeah, just let me get educated here. What do you call these things?
They're called passenger facility charges, or PSCs.
And that's, you could put per passenger charge?
It's anywhere from $1 to $3 on every plane passenger at the first two stops that they were planning.
Okay, so, and that is the only thing you could do this for? You couldn't, as an example, attempt to tax tourists for the state's marketing program, tourist marketing program, as an example?
Not through a PFC.
Not through a PFC. I mean, call it something else. Could you do it calling it something else?
No, the FAA was very specific in what they authorized any kind of a head tax.
So the head tax law enforcement.
Okay.
Right. And this was the exception to that.
Okay, thank you.
As Gina alluded, one of the problems we're having is, since we're primarily the Alaskans paying this charge, you know, it's not just, if there was some way just to say, okay, only the tourists pay, we'd probably be asking permission to enact it now. But it would be everybody flying. A lot of the airports in the lower 48 have pushed it on that people with the attitude, well, if you don't pay it here, you're going to pay it somewhere else when you get on the plane. A lot of our traffic is strictly interstate, or it goes from Anchorage to Seattle, Anchorage to Portland, and they're not getting on and off two or three other times. So it's really something that we would be taxing Alaskans, a direct tax, and we would be able to sell it. If you don't pay us, you'll be paying another airport. And therefore, we've really been waiting before we think about enacting one, having a project that Alaskans would be behind, as opposed to just asking for improvements.
Senator Frank, and then Senator Kelly.
No, very good. What difference would it make? I mean, why would you use this versus just passing the cost through the airlines in the form of higher landing fees? I mean, we're talking about the same people, right?
We want to keep our landing fees as competitive as possible to attract new carriers. Even though we have an agreement where the carriers are on the hook to pay everything, we can make those prices so expensive that they'll find alternate ways of flying around Alaska.
I guess you would also have a ship, in the case of a cargo airline, that wouldn't have any passengers. You would be able to keep your landing costs low for cargo. Maybe you probably have a different schedule for cargo versus passenger.
Is it the same?
Well, that's interesting. Why is that?
It's based on the weight of the takeoff weight of the aircraft, maximum takeoff weight. and we don't distinguish between cargo and passenger.
But the passenger flights use the terminal facilities to a greater extent, don't they?
But they pay passengers, they pay rent, space rent, and gate use fees for terminal that the other carriers don't pay.
Thank you.
Senator Kelly?
The $3 charge that you say you collect at the ticket counter, can't you roll that into the ticket price? I mean, it seems to me that you can do that if you buy your ticket.
The airlines charge it, and then they keep like 40 to 60 cents, and we get the rest to be back to the airport. We don't write it as a plane ticket. It's nothing that we would charge directly to passengers as they're coming to return stop.
If we could, Senator Cutula?
We build the fire stations out of bonding or direct capital?
Federal money and revenue fund.
We have three fire stations there now?
Well, yeah, we do. The first one is not used.
Very much overextended in fire support.
I'm sorry?
I'll check the direct. But I just heard that you're very much overextended in fire support. You don't need near what you get in the fire station.
The new fire station made the other two obsolete, and they're not used now.
Do you still have coolers?
Yes.
So, I mean, you've got the Air National Guard, which is a separate system right across the runway.
It's a supplemental to our, yeah.
Are they 24-hour duty over there?
I don't know the answer to that.
If we could, let's go through the individual projects, and just because in our book they come first, we take Anchorage first. It's not too soon.
Okay, and I think first we hear John.
In case you haven't gathered, I'm the controller for the International Airport System. My name is John Unger. Typically, both airports normally put in their capital projects. The only time the system office has one is when it's going to benefit both airports, and they don't. So there's three capital projects this year that are being presented from the system office. The first one is for environmental assessment and cleanup. Continuing requirements from EPA and DEC. For the last 2 years, we've asked for $2 million each year for environmental assessment money. This year, we're scaling it down a bit for $1 million, and the money's strictly there to evaluate what type of hazardous waste or environmental problems might be sitting at the two airports, and to start cleaning it up and then take preventive actions, hopefully so it won't happen in the future. The way this pop money would work is when either airport identifies an environmental area that they require funds, they would then come to the system office and ask to use this $1 million pot.
So you keep a separate, it doesn't really revolve, but a separate fund off to the side with an account balance, an ongoing balance, and then Jean Marie and Bob come to you and say, I have this specific problem, I need to find out how big a problem I have, or I'd like to clean X up.
Typically, what this is to determine how big of a project, the bigger a problem that might be out there. If there's a large problem that's going to, and there's going to be a capital project in that area, the capital project typically would ask for funds to do the cleanup.
Mm-hmm.
Where these monies have been used in the past have been to pull underground storage tanks around Lake Hood, to do sewer cleanups. It's strictly more of an assessment rather than small cleanups where there won't be any other capital projects in those areas. It's not really, I guess in a way it's a revolving fund. It would only have $1 million. When it was totally exhausted, we would be coming back to the legislature asking for a new appropriation.
Okay.
The second capital project really isn't a project. It's for reimbursable services authority. Quite frequently, we'll be doing capital projects, and one of our tenants will ask us to do something that's not in the scope of our normal capital project. We've done this with Federal X and Federal Express and UPS, and what they're asking basically is for us to do a project that they'll, as part of our overall project, that they'll reimburse us for. The general fund has this type of authority, and it's sort of an accounting headache anytime that we have this third-party reimbursement.